is the song that rounds off the album Everybody's Angel, which was Tanita Tikaram's album from 1991. Absolutely gorgeous, that, isn't it? I'm Going Home. Nice one, Paul.
Beautiful, yeah. Resets the mood.
Choice of my guest this afternoon on the afternoon show, Paul Lynham, Leicestershire astronomer. And let's talk a bit more about then this work that you did at the University of Kent at Canterbury that really turned out to be of great interest to NASA.
Yeah, so we have comets in our solar system. They're dirty snowballs. As they get closer to the sun, they warm up and they cast off gases, but they also cast off dust behind them. They leave this particle trail, and when they get close to the Earth or over the decades, then millennia, they spread out and they populate the environment around the Earth with these particles, and then the Earth plows through them when we see the shooting stars. Occasionally, when fresh debris is deposited by a comet that's recently passed, then you get these concentrated blocks of dust particles near Earth. So that's a hazard for space platforms, satellites that do telecommunications, the space shuttle as it was then operating, space telescopes and expensive hardware. Because the speeds involved for these things to impact with these tiny dust grains are huge. So they can completely disable a satellite or a space station, for example. There are stories about the Soviet space cosmonauts inside the Mir spacecraft hiding when they hear the thuds on the hull of the space station of these things impacting. So NASA and the space operators like British Aerospace were very keen to predict what was going to happen in the following near passage of a comet that deposited new debris around the turn of the millennium, around 1999-2000. So we were involved in trying to predict and go back through the annals of history, the recorded apparitions of this particular comet that comes around every 33 years, generates a meteor storm every 33 years, we thought, called the Leonids. It comes from the constellation of Leo, so it's called the Leonids.
Mm-hmm.
So we were involved in trying to predict how dense the particles would be and the level of threat that they posed to spacecraft. And the upshot was that people like British Aerospace and NASA were coming to us and asking, you know, for us to predict and provide advice on how to operate the spacecraft during this critical period around the turn of the millennium. And as a result of that, you know, the space shuttle was not flown. The Hubble Space Telescope was manoeuvred because they have huge solar panels on them which are very, very delicate. So it's like hitting a piece of glass at high speed and it can disable the solar panel. And various other people were involved in trying to tell NASA, right, you don't really want to be operating these things or feathering. It's called the operation is called feathering the solar panels to the direction from which these meteoroids are actually approaching.
Basically turn them sideways on so it does less damage.
Absolutely,
well.
Yes.
Yeah. How fascinating. So, I mean, that must have been a really exciting time for you.
Yeah, and there was a lot going on at the time. So we worked with people who had been previously involved in the Giotto space mission, which went through the tail of Halley's Comet in the late 80s. At the time, there were teams working down at the university there to build what became the Philae lander that landed on the Rosetta. It was deposited by Rosetta and landed on the comet at the tail end of last year. And also there were teams there that were building the lander for landing on Titan, which is the moon of Saturn, the largest moon in the solar system. It has an atmosphere. And they had no idea when they were building this thing 10 years in advance that, you know, what type of surface these landers would be landing on. Would it be rock, sand, liquid petroleum, creme brulee? They had no idea. So there was a lot of experimentation going on at that time to try and work out how can they detect the type of surface that they're going to be landing on from radar signals before they actually arrived on the surface. Then they had to build these things and put them on a trickle charge on the parent spacecraft for 7 to 10 years in a cruise phase to go to the destination. So if you had your mobile phone and left it on a trickle charge for 7 years and then tried to start it up again, you'd be pretty uncertain about whether it would all function properly. And this was the problem these guys faced, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. And Rosetta Philae and Cassini-Huygens at Saturn and Titan were great successes.
Yeah, amazing. Although, what's happened? We haven't really heard about the Philae lander in recent times. We assume it kind of ran out of charge because it didn't quite get in the line of the sun or something.
That's right.
Correct?
I believe it landed, and they landed near a crevice, and it was in an awkward position, and they didn't get quite the illumination, the solar illumination as the comet turned, that they were hoping for. So my understanding is that at least the batteries may have discharged.
Yeah. But after all that, but nevertheless, it has to be said that that must have been regarded as a success.
Oh yeah, it's quite some achievement.
Thought that you could possibly land a spacecraft on a comet, for goodness sake. Absolutely unbelievable that. And then sort of during this period, it was when you met, well, your now current wife.
Yes, or the first Mrs. Lineman, I should say. Yes, so this was all done at Canterbury, the University of Kent at Canterbury, and at the time that had the highest population of foreign students in the country. So for me, a provincial lad coming from, you know, little old Leicestershire, it was a great experience to interact with all these different cultures and people. You know, you would meet people and end up talking to them, and they'd say, "Where are you from?" "Oh, Kazakhstan," you know. And luckily for me, with my interest in space, that's where they launch the rockets from. So as soon as you say, "Oh, are you from Baikonur or something?" they go, "Oh, you know Kazakhstan." So it was a great conversation opener at some level. But I met my wife, and she happens to be from Thailand, and we met there and became friends, and we married some time later.
Blimey. So did she actually end up going to Liverpool with you? Because that's where you went to do your PhD, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I moved to Liverpool, but we were in Canterbury for 1 year, and then we went off and did our own thing. So for something like 8 years, we were dating from across two continents. At some level, we were rarely in the same continent together.
Oh,
so people complain about long-distance relationships, but I'm sure you can make it work.
Absolutely. I haven't seen anything, have they, really? So tell us a little bit about what happened when you went to Liverpool then. Why did you particularly go there?
Well, Liverpool was the great opportunity that I was really waiting for, because, as I said before, all of the time I wanted access to telescopes, and I wanted to see and point them at galaxies and gas clouds in space. And this was the opportunity. So I had the chance to do some research, guided by the astronomers at Liverpool John Moores University, to survey the whole of the sky and photograph what are called clusters of galaxies. So we know that our Milky Way is a galaxy, but it doesn't live alone. It lives in a little group of galaxies. It turns out galaxies are very friendly, gregarious. They don't like being lonely. So we also have larger agglomerations of galaxies that are called clusters. So what you can do is you can survey the whole collection of clusters of galaxies around the Earth in space and work out how the Milky Way galaxy is moving towards them, and compare them with other reference directions and work out the overall motion of this collection of clusters of galaxies. And it turns out that you can measure the largest scale motions in the universe by using this technique. So I was surveying these galaxies, and because we needed to look at the whole of the sky, it meant travelling to use telescopes all over the world. So we were flying down to South Africa and down to Chile and into the Canary Islands. We have some, the UK operated some telescopes in the Canary Islands and Greece and so on, regularly every 6 months or so, trying to get the observations and trying to find good weather and high altitude telescopes where we could make the observations to refine our understanding of Big Bang cosmology. Structures of the type that were suggested by the research that had gone before us were impossible to develop such a large-scale mass in the age of the universe. So we were seeing signals that were kind of counterintuitive to our model, the Big Bang cosmological model. So we were trying to clarify the signal a bit and make it fit back with what we thought we understood.
You need to have a brain the size of a planet to understand all this, literally almost, don't you? So, I mean, it is an incredibly complex thing, and I suppose as the, you know, as time goes on, the complexity of the instruments that you have to measure such things just improves all the time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would say it's not a question of brain power, it's a question of your level of interest.
Yeah.
I don't consider, you know, that I'm particularly, you know, gifted in any way. I just have a very specific interest that motivates me. But yes, certainly the instruments, the cameras that we build for these things are forever getting more and more complex. The telescopes are getting larger and larger and larger. And even now, the types of cameras and telescopes that we're building, no single nation can build them alone. So nations are clubbing together now. So the UK is part of what's called the European Southern Observatory, which has a series of telescopes down in Latin America that are cutting-edge telescopes. And the Americans and Canada and the Japanese and China are joining together to build large telescopes as well.
So you got your PhD in Liverpool then, and then you're on your travels again, I believe, after that.
Yeah, so one of my collaborators who was working in this research in Liverpool invited me at the end of the PhD to go out to live and work in Munich to continue the research.
Well, talk about that after you've given us another choice of song.
Okay, so the next choice of song is a Scottish band called Runrig, and it's called A Book of Golden Stories.